Translation. The king of this planet, Maharaj Ambarish, thus performed devotional service to the Lord, and in this endeavor practiced severe austerity, always satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By his constitutional activities, he gradually gave up all material desires. Please repeat. The king of this planet, Maharaj Ambarish, thus performed devotional service to the Lord, and in this endeavor practiced severe austerity, always satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead by his constitutional activities. He gradually gave up all material desires. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Severe austerities in the practice of devotional service are of many varieties. For example, in worshipping the deity in the temple, there are certainly laborious activities. See Vigrahara Ardhana Nityanana Singhara Tanmandira Marjanado. One must decorate the deity, cleanse the temple, bring water from the Ganges and Yamuna, continue the routine work, perform arti many times, prepare first-class food for the deity, prepare dresses and so on. In this way, one must constantly be engaged in various activities, and the hard labor involved is certainly an austerity. Similarly, the hard labor involved in preaching, preparing literature, preaching to atheistic men, and distributing literature door to door is, of course, an austerity. Tapo yuktena. Tapo divyam putraka. Such austerity is necessary. Yena sattam sudyat. By such austerity, in devotional service, one is purified of material existence. Kaman shaner jaho. Indeed, such austerity leads one to the constitutional position of devotional service. In this way, one can give up material desires. And as soon as one is freed from material desires, he is free from the repetition of birth and death, old age, and disease. The king of this planet, Maharaj Ambarish, thus performed devotional service to the Lord, and in this endeavor practiced severe austerity, always satisfying the Supreme Personality of Godhead by his constitutional activities. He gradually gave up all material desire. So, the ninth canto is very, the whole Srimad Bhagavatam is very nice, but the ninth canto is kind of like, it's almost like there's an extra devotional joy in the whole canto and an anticipation of what's to come perhaps in the tenth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam of Krishna. You may remember, right? Whole Bhagavatam is all this series of endless questions. Endless questions. Isn't it? It's considered that, you know, to what's the qualities of the disciple? Pranipat. Pariprashna. And seva. Isn't it? That these are the great qualities of the disciple. The guru has to have nice qualities. Important qualities. Disciple also. Pranipat means complete homage. One approaches the teacher for knowledge of devotional life. With pranipat means falling down, really. Pranipat. You just fall over in offering full respects and honor to another. Complete regard. Complete regard to another. And not that I'm coming to capitalize from something here that will serve my selfish purpose in life. I will become all-knowing. I become very learned. You know, in devotional life, it's not overly recommended. Rupa Goswami states, to take too many disciples, to read too many books, to build too many temples. He says that these things are they're not helpful in devotional life. One disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta said, when I read these qualities, I'm thinking of you opening so many temples. He said, it all depends on a man's capacity or a woman's capacity. It depends. One person can't run a small shop. Another person can open a whole big corporate all over the world, everywhere, and still go and play golf. Isn't it? Every time you see the American president, you know, when some big calamity is going on in the world, he's playing golf, something like that. Just pick up, oh, all right, don't, I'll manage it later. So, the depends on the capacity of an individual. Prabhupada had a humongous capacity for spreading Krishna consciousness. It's superbly empowered, isn't it? Sometimes we all say, Prabhupada, Shaktyavesh Avatar. It was Godbrother that introduced that language of referring to Prabhupada, is Sridhar Maharaj. He said, yes, he's empowered. Someone was complaining to him. Prabhupada was giving lectures, I think, in South India. And someone was complaining that Swami Prabhupada, I don't think they would have referred to him as Prabhupada, but Swami Bhaktivedanta, he says, you know, his mission is spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world while his god brothers are ringing bells in the temple. So, this complaint was brought to Prabhupada's god brother, Sridhar Maharaj, by other people. And he said, he's spreading Krishna consciousness all over the world. What have we accomplished? He says, if your service in terms of that great mission is ringing a bell, then ring a bell. Humongous capacity for spreading Krishna consciousness. So, certain things are, they're, as I was saying, they're not recommended. To take on too many disciples, isn't it? Oh, I'm not having my disciples anymore. I can't, you know, it's just not possible. And then the demand, isn't it? They say also, life after life. As you pray like that, isn't it? You're my guru, life after life. Imagine when you have a troubled person who's just not managing it. You think, oh my gosh, how much longer can I go on like this? But obviously that the Karuna Sindh, the great ocean of compassion has the capacity to manage it. And reading so many books, obviously, that's okay. That when the endeavor is just for knowledge and knowledge in and of itself, and to be able to, you know, when anybody ever comes on some subject, you want to be able to say things which, well, you're very literate in that subject. You're very knowledgeable, isn't it? And in that way, what would you say? It serves egoistic purposes. Also, some, you know, obviously, Vedacharya or great Acharya devotees are able to write and read and quote so many commentaries and etc., etc. But if the one doesn't catch the essence of it all and spends their entire time in endless researching the subject, then that in itself is also, one must have the capacity. So the quality of disciple, Paniput, Pariprashna, and Seva, the devotee offers complete homage, gives complete respect and honor, and has no separate interest other than understanding from the teacher the subject of devotion and approaching that subject with the Sevan Mukatha, Seva, Pariprashna, and Seva, the Buddha's service. The Buddha's almost adoration, respect, affection, ultimately love, Vishram Bena Guru Seva. As Rupa Goswami writes, Adau Guru Padashaya, the threshold to bhakti. He says, these three things constitute the threshold to bhakti. Adau Guru Padashaya, this is the pranipat, the approach a master of devotion. Someone who is situated well, a connoisseur of devotion, a master of devotion. Adau Guru Padashaya. Take the tutelage, is that what you say? The tutelage of such a person. Take the guidance of such a person. See Krishna Diksha Shikshanam. Make your vows before a person like that. They'll give you the things to do. Shikshanam. They'll give you advice on the road. How to progress. Vishram Bena Guru Seva. And the whole attitude towards such a person. Vishramba. Beyond adoration is a tremendous affection for such a person. Guru Sorida Sorida. It's stated that in the Brahma... Is it... Prahlad Maharaj's teachings and what's a brahmachari? I'm sure some brahmacharis can quote that verse. Brahmachari Guru Kuli. Guru Das. Vasandanto Guru Ritam. What's the next line? Acharan Dasavan Nitsyo Guru Sorida Sorida. Prabhupada says like a menial servant washing the floor. Just like a menial person in the home of the guru. And the mindset towards the teacher. Like a menial. He said, Nietzsche, low, very low. But living in a relationship of intimacy and friendship, the most endearing person, the teacher. So, sevaya, pariprashna seva, the whole reciprocation of his of service. As Prabhupada says, not only service, but menial service. And pariprashna, the whole thing comes from the inquisitiveness of the student. Prabhupada, isn't the Krishna book, he writes about the sadhu is like the rain cloud. He's like the big cloud in the rainy season, which sometimes rains and sometimes doesn't rain. As you know, when July, isn't it? When the rainy season starts to come to Vrindavan. It's tremendously dry in Vrindavan, the dry heat of Vrindavan. You don't sweat in Vrindavan in the summer because the sweat just evaporates. Mayapur was a different story, isn't it? You're always swimming in the Ganga. Well, there's always somebody there. Dry heat in Vrindavan. And so, when the humidity begins to grow and the dark clouds become to hang overhead, everyone's waiting for it to burst. Anticipating, sort of, You have memories. I have memories of Ayendra Prabhu dancing in the rain on the roof of the Gurukula. Because when the first big clouds would burst, everybody would run out. Because everybody was mostly in their rooms at that time of year. It was quite unbearable to be outside. With the windows closed and the fan switched off. Because the fan made it more difficult. So hot. We used to drive in the Gurukul bus in the heat with the windows closed because the air coming through the windows was hotter than the air inside. So when the first, those big rain clouds would come over Vrindavan, everyone would be just anticipating the cloud burst. And it would come in floods. And Ayendra Prabhu would come out and dance on the roof in the rain. And things would begin to cool down. Prabhupada compares the sadhu to the rain cloud. Because sometimes he may speak and sometimes he may not speak. But what leads out the great gems, or mining the great gems of their realization of Krishna consciousness, comes from the inquisitive inquiry, the pariprashna, questions of a higher order. I remember years ago I was in Jagannath Puri and I was staying in an ashram called the Chaitanya Chandradwaya Ashram near Gundicha. I think it was in the 80s. And I found out there was a disciple of Bhaktisiddhanta living there. And so I went to see him. He was sitting on the veranda. Very senior Swami. And I said to him, can you tell me about your relationship with Srila Prabhupada? And he turned to me and he said, what business is that of yours? He said, why don't you ask something directly related to your own spiritual progress? I mean, it was quite a blunt answer. I was quite taken back. But obviously, he was quite independent in the way he was choosing to respond to my inquiry. He's not like an answering machine. You come and put £1 in and you get your answer. It's not purchasable, isn't it? It's not something that is purchasable in the market. It comes of the volition of the realized devotee. So what provokes the realized devotee to share such information? As we know in the Gita, isn't it? The end of the Gita. What's just after Krishna has explained everything. Then he said, this isn't for everyone. People who are not austere, people who are envious. You know, everybody literally who's going to depreciate the subject is not for them. Don't. It's almost like, it's kind of equivocal. He says, the person who teaches this is the greatest devotee. And then he says, but don't teach it to all these people. Because depreciation of the subject will be more harmful to somebody than if they haven't heard the subject at all. You're putting them in a very precarious position. Isn't it? Where they never had a knife to cut their throat, you hand them the sharpest blade. Isn't it? Shastra. It's also a weapon. So therefore, it's considered that in this regard, then don't be foolish. In the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati Thakur writes, that there's a certain category of person where only opeksha will do. Opeksha means I'll have nothing to do with this person. No engagement. Nothing. Upeksha. I'm not going to touch that. Isn't it? They say like that. Oh, I won't touch that with a barge pole. Upeksha. Troubled people. People who are envious will depreciate very strongly. Then upeksha. He said, if you think you're such an uttam adhikari that you can still speak to such a person, then your destiny is tragedy yourself. Don't think it, that I'm so advanced. Oh, only upeksha will be in this person's interest. You have, isn't it? As Srila Prabhupada said, with the monkeys in Vrindavan, he said, don't become their friends, don't become their enemy. You may have that experience. I think it was Sridham, I don't know if he's here, Sridham Prabhu. I think Sridham was feeding monkeys in Fogal Ashram once, and they kind of caught hold of him, isn't it? Quite seriously. They can bite you very badly. One student was bitten by monkeys in the arm. I had to take him from injections. Some local doctor. Something like, it was Sanaka. Sanaka Prabhu. He had to take him on the back of a bicycle to the doctor. The doctor had to give him like 7 injections in the stomach for rabies. Very vicious. They look extremely playful, but they're so vicious. Especially the breed that's in Vrindavan. They are so vicious. Sometimes they harass the old ladies so much, they have to round them up and take them off to some forest somewhere, far away. So, Prabhupada's recommendation was, somebody was sharing a thing recently on internet of some soldiers in Africa with a monkey, and the monkey was standing with his hands up in the air like this, and they're all like, you saw it. You might not know Sanskrit, but you're online. So the monkey was dancing with his hands up in the air, right? Isn't it? And then they're all laughing at the monkey. They're all laughing at it, joking. And then one of those African soldiers like hands it an AK-47. And the monkey's standing with his AK-47, right? And then it puts his hand on the trigger. And all the soldiers are running and jumping and running in every direction. You see, all of a sudden they get really serious. And the thing starts shooting them. Another, in the Niti Shastra, there's one account where it's teaching the example, better an intelligent enemy than a fool for a friend. You know, an intelligent enemy, some long stories, the stories are endless. It's told of some criminals steal some jewels and then they swallow the jewels and the jewels are in somebody's stomach and they get captured and they're all going to be killed, and the one who has the jewels realizes he's going to be killed anyway, so he's an enemy of the others, but he's an intelligent one, and he thinks, well, everyone's going to be killed, so I might as well be killed, let them live. So the point's made, better an intelligent enemy. And the fool for a friend, the example is given of an ape, and a king who had a pet ape, and he always had it with him. It was Michael Jackson. Didn't he have a monkey? Chimpanzee, wasn't he? He kept it with him all the time. A few people have, Tarzan also, he was the one who started all that. So, the ape was with the king, and it went everywhere with him. He laughed, he joked. The ape was his close friend. And then once the ape would do everything for him. And once the king was lying sleeping in his palatial gardens, and there was a bee flying around the king. And finally the bee flew closer and closer and just was about to land on the face of the king. So the ape thought to help him, picked up his sword, swung and cut his head off by axes, you know. So fool for a friend, it's not recommended. So with opeksha, those who are potentially to do damage to themselves or others. Interestingly enough, the whole chapter here is about Durvasam, Durvasa Rishi. Durvasa is like one of the, it's the literal meaning of a name is like a person whose presence is extremely problematic. When Brahma and Shiva were fighting, squalling over something, Shiva's anger would just always take over completely. And Parvati just got so upset with it. She just like, Durvasam Bhavati me, this, your anger is just, it's impossible to live with you. There's no happiness in living with you. I don't know if you've ever heard your wife saying anything like that to you. This is Durvasam. Your presence is making it impossible. Or this is an impossible place to reside. So something had to be done with that side of Shiva. That anger of Shiva had to go someplace. So later, and as the stories go on, that isn't that great lady whose husband was debauched, and he was cursed, isn't it, to die by the sunset. And she thought that by the power of her devotion to her husband, that she would stop the sun from setting. And this did happen, and it became a big problem for all the devatas. So somehow the thing was reconciled, and in due course, Anasuya reconciled it, and Anasuya received a blessing. And she said, well, I'd like three sons, one of Vishnu, one of Brahma, and one of Shiva. Was it Chandra, Dattatreya? And then that part of Shiva had a place to go. Okay, let's take the Durvasam of Shiva, and there it is now, in the personality of Durvas. Durvas was an overwhelming, troubling person. I mean, in Krishna Leela, Krishna refers to him as, he stayed Durvas Kuti, you cross the Yamuna from Mathura, and there's Durvas Kuti. And that's where the gopis went, wasn't it? When Krishna came so late to meet the gopis. So late, they said to him, where were you? Shishi Radha Gokulam. They asked, where were you? And he said, I was with my Gurudev. And they're like, what? And he began to preach to them very strongly about Dharma and these things, and say that he was with his guru. This took them by great surprise, because they had known him for conduct which was completely inconsistent with his speech. So then he claimed before them that he was the best amongst all the brahmacharis. Now, you know, if you had a member of your ashram that was imitating the behavior of Krishna, then perhaps you'd say, he needs to change to white. Or maybe worse. They said, what? How can these words even come from your mouth? Brahmachari, best of all the brahmacharis, Balya Brahmachari. He said, just as my Gurudev exists from just taking the water of Kusha, then in the same way I'm a brahmachari. They said, we want to meet this guru of yours. He said, okay, you can go. And they said, how will we cross the Yamuna? He said, well, when you're going, just say on the strength of Krishna's vrata of brahmacharya, then let us cross. So you know the story anyway. It went, it worked, it was quick. The gopis, they took like hundreds of food items for the sadhu. And they took his blessing, and when they put the food before Durvas, he devoured it like a man with a hunger to devour the universe. And they were thinking, he's proclaiming to be a Brahmachari. What was it? And then they said Durvas, wasn't it? Just before they said, how we cross the Yamuna to go back. He said, on the strength of my vrata, only to take the water of Durvas, of Kusha. Then, they're thinking, what was it they said? They actually says there, Yata Guru Tata Chela. Just as the Guru, so is the Chela, the disciple. His nature is consistent. They both seem like they're being completely untruthful. So when they asked Krishna ultimately the whole riddle of the thing, then he said, no, I'm living and passing my time with all of you in reciprocation to your aspirations to serve me. But as for myself, I'm Atmaram. Then he says, and with regards to my Gurudev, for his own subsistence, he only takes the water of Kusha. But because you all brought offerings of devotion, then for your benefit, he accepted all these things. This Durvasa. But this was a nice pastime of Durvasa. Other pastimes are extremely troubling. Like when Durvasa went to stay with the Pandavas and everybody in Indraprastha, I think it was. He came, as soon as he walked into the city, they're all like, oh, Krishna. Because, you know, Grihastha is meant to take care of guests and all those things, but they thought, Durvasam, he's the one he's impossible to exist with. Where if he comes to stay with us or do anything with us, then we'll all be finished. Here, he's such a gentleman of Ambarish Maharaj. He even cursed him. What to speak of everyone else? So everybody was very, very worried to take care of him. I think this little story came in response to a question in the Mahabharata, and that was about respecting brahmanas. And some of the Pandavas were having a tremendous job in respecting some of the brahmanas because their conduct wasn't always consistent with what they espoused or what was meant to be their conduct. I was reading a story recently of Ramanuja, where Ramanuja was, I'll just remember to come back to that thing about Durvasa, where Ramanuja was really teaching his Brahmin disciples were just becoming a bit carried away with the whole status of Brahmanism. Really. And when he had one disciple, his name was Dhanurdas. And Dhanurdas was a big wrestler. And he had also, how he appeared one day was he was carrying an umbrella for a beautiful woman. And he was just glaring into the eyes of the woman so much that he was completely unconscious of everything else in life. And everybody was quite shocked about this, and he was unabashed. He was just right there, you know, staring right into her face, carrying her umbrella for her. And seeing this, some, I think, disciples of Ramanuja, some Ramanujans, they were asked to inquire, what are you doing? He said, well, I've never seen anything more beautiful. So I thought I might as well just dedicate myself to that. And just keep my eyes, everybody likes beauty, isn't it? You see it, it's beautiful. So, anyway, through some trickery, Ramanuja arranged for him to come to see the temple, and in the darkened temple, in the lamplight, he saw the beautiful eyes of Lord Vishnu. He was a convert. And so was his wife, whose name was, I can't remember. So Dhanurdas became very close to Ramanuja, and when Ramanuja used to go from place to place, he used to walk holding on to the arm of Dhanurdas. And because he was obviously a wrestler, Kushti in India is called, isn't it? Kushti. The Kushti wrestlers. They have like ashrams. They live as followers of Hanuman, and they wrestle as their dharma. And they were perturbed. They're all like Brahmins, and he's like, he was a wrestler, and everywhere Ramanuja is going with him. Isn't it? So Ramanuja thought, I have to show these disciples, teach them a lesson. So he went, and I believe he tore their cloth, wasn't it, when they were sleeping? He tore some pieces from their cloth or whatever. And they all got up, and they were all upset. Who's done this and who's done that? Challenging each other to the extreme degree. So after this, then, he told them, look, do one thing. It is night now. I'm keeping Dhanurdas here. You go to where his wife is. She's sleeping. Steal her jewelry. So anyway, they took the instruction. The guru, they all went there. She's lying there sleeping, and they started to take the golden bangles off her wrist. She was lying there, and she thought, oh, these Brahmins, they must be so poor. They've come to steal my jewelries. How unfortunate for their lives. Let me just roll over and give them the other ones too. So she rolled over. They all got a big fright, and they all ran away. So then when they came back, then the Ramanuja said, now follow Dhanurdas and see what exchange happens in the house. So they all went back. He went back. His wife said, you know what happens? These Brahmins came. They were so poor. They must have been so hungry. They came. They stole my bangles. I thought, you know, better they have them. They need them more than me. And so I wanted to give them other bangles. So I rolled over, but they ran away. And Dhanurdas said, you know, you really got it wrong, you know. Why are you even assuming they're yours to give? Why do you have a sense of ownership towards these things? These are not, they're not yours whatsoever. If you had just laid still, they would have probably taken them. So the Brahmins were all like, well, that's really quite high level of renunciation. So they went back to Ramanuja, and Ramanuja corrected them all. He said, see, this is the thing now. You're all wrapped up in your caste consciousness. But the real thing is in the substance of your lives. And just see here, he's something else. All right, he was a wrestler and all those things. But just look at the renunciation of this person. It's absolutely profound. So this was related to, yeah, they were unimpressed with the Brahman, because the Brahmanas, their behavior was, it wasn't good behavior. Ramanuja is making the very important point about the behavior, the conduct, not the caste. And so in the Pandavas were, they were concerned about the behavior, and Krishna was saying, you just have to respect them anyway. That's it, final. So when Durvasa came, the most formidable amongst them all, then came Krishna's challenge. So Krishna and Rukmini hosted Durvas. And when Durvas was staying with them, he put them through the hoops and over the hurdles. And even at one point, he said, I want to go for a ride around this place in a... It was in Dwarka then, was it? I want to go for a ride around this place in a carriage, but don't use horses. Krishna and Rukmini, you pull it. Wasn't it? Another time he told Krishna he was served some payas or pudding or something. He said to Krishna, after requesting it, can you spread this all over your body? Krishna took it. He spread it all over himself, except for his feet. So after the whole thing of pulling the chariot with Durvasa on it, because they were determined they're going to succeed in this challenge, the challenge placed upon them by their guest, they will succeed. Everyone was like in shock when it got to this point. Rukmini, she's a queen. What's this Durvasa? So finally, in the completion of this whole thing, he turned to Krishna. He blessed Rukmini. He blessed Krishna that you will never be killed by any weapon. You'll never be harmed in any place of your body which has been covered with this pious. And he never covered his feet. That was the arrow, wasn't it? The foot of Krishna. So powerful, but so worrying, so dangerous. So here, Durvas, he came, stayed here, and challenged Ambarish to such a severe degree. Now, obviously, the main points that's pushed here is that in the pursuit of bhakti, this relationship between bhakti and tapa, it's a tremendous austerity, certainly, being a king. This is his swadharma. To do it all for Krishna and to remain with the task at hand was a tremendous level of tapasya's involved. Tapasya in itself is not an anga of bhakti. Naradito yadi haris tapasa tatakim. Aradito yadi haris tapasa tatakim. Antar bahir yadi haris tapasa tatakim. Nantar bahir yadi haris tapasa tatakim. If somebody has understood Krishna as inside and outside of everything, there's no necessity of tapasya. It doesn't serve any purpose. And if a person doesn't know that, it doesn't serve any purpose. If someone's a worshipper of Krishna, then tapasya doesn't serve any purpose. And if someone's not a worshipper of Krishna, then tapasya doesn't serve any purpose. Then Narad Rishi says, well, what a purpose does tapasya tatakim? Why tapasya? People make a life out of tapasya. Make a business out of tapasya. Narad Rishi is saying, well, what is the validity of the tapasya? What purpose does tapasya serve? But on the other hand, Prabhupada's quoting in the verse itself, tapo divyam putrika yena sattam. Remember that verse? Nayam deha deha bhajam niloke. It was always one we'd quote regularly. Because of kastam kamam vidbujam. Why are you working so hard to just be like a stool-eating animal? That was a tremendous line in preaching. Vidbujam ye. No, life's not meant for that. Tapo divyam putraka. It's meant for tapasya. Divine tapasya. Tapo putram. Putraka yena sattam. And that way you'll be free. And that way you'll be free. Same in the Gita, Krishna mentions, isn't it? And that way you'll be free. After this matra spasas to kuntes agama painonitis tamstatiks yam hi navyata yantyeti purusham purushashaba samat sukha sama dukkha sukham dira somrit tattvaya kalpati. By this forbearance, you'll be free. That amidst these things, sama dukkha sukham dira, by being dira amongst the sukh, the dukkh, sama dukkha sukham dira somrit tattvaya kalpati, you'll be free. By tapasya, this forbearance. Tapaha literally means to burn it. Tapasya of burning. Heat. Pain for the mind, pain for the body. Tapasya, tapaha. This is Brahma's first words. Tapaha. Narad Rishi is saying, what is the value, validity of tapasya? Brahma's first words were tapa. Again, this is a completely kind of equivocal, where one side tapasya is being pushed, on the other side Narad Rishi is just throwing it. Tapasya tatakim. What's the Brahma's like tapasya? Narad Rishi is like, what's the use of it? Rupa Goswami reconciles this and the teachings of Uttama Bhakti, and I'll just finish on this point. He reconciles this in the teachings of bhakti. Whereas when he's speaking of all the angas of bhakti, when he comes to the point of delineating what is not an anga of bhakti, there he mentions the jnana vairagya specifically. This is renunciation of things. Also in nivrityatmik being an element of sadhana bhakti, or the things that you denounce. In bhakti, there's pravrityatmik, there's the things we must do, and nivrityatmik, the things we best stay away from, the things we leave aside. Whether they're activities, whether they're temperaments, whether they're emotions, whatever, they must be left aside. Rupa Goswami says, and leaving things aside is important in devotional life, because it facilitates one to get on with devotional life. So vairagya, or renunciation, is only important in as much as it is a practice that facilitates one in the early stages of devotion. Dwar pravesh, it's a door, it's a pravesh, it's one of those beginnings. So some vairagya is important in the beginning of devotional life, because we can't embrace the angas of devotion as long as we're doing all the other things. So the amount of renunciation that's required is that just for this time, while I am in Mangalarti, this is one for me, I'm not going to check my phone. Really? Somebody said to me in a meeting the other day, they said, that was really insulting what you did. I said, what did I do? They said, that person was giving you a report and you started checking your phone. I said, I didn't even notice I did that. There's a new term for it. Even I think Oxford have accepted the term. Pizzled. It means you're both pizzled and something else offed. Pizzled. I just, you know, leave it. To go to the east, you have to not be going to the west. You have to be going to the east. You know, to go on your, like, when my daughter was just a baby, whenever we would leave something, she'd be holding on to it with an anxiousness. No, we're just going. We're just going through the customs of the airport. We're just going to put our bags to go through the x-ray. She was like, two, no, what? We're giving away our things. She couldn't even speak, but she knew what was happening. We're like, no, you have to give it up here. You have to give it up or we're not going to be able to move forward, isn't it? You get to the airport, they say, I'm sorry, you can't take the liquids. Oh, I forgot. Can I? No, Bennett. You can't go on unless you leave it. And so in the life of bhakti, moving forward depends upon leaving so many things. To move to the next class, you got to be with the right people. You got to leave the ones who are the detriment to your studies. You have to leave the lower environments. You have to progress. It's a path of attachment. Going in the right. So all those things, they must be left. What's the pain in leaving those things is the tapasya. That's what's burning. It's burning. Remember the first meeting with the Bhakta director of Sukadev Prabhu years ago? He said to me, oh, you want to, after staying in the ashram for a couple of weeks, he said, how's it going with everything? I said, it's going great. He said, how's your material desires? I said, I haven't got any. I had just burned myself so badly. I was so burnt out, you know, with everything, burnt out. And he said, as you have in these confidential meetings in the ashram, how's your sex desire? I said, I don't have any. He laughed at me. It becomes the arduous journey, you know, as you go on. The things that you lived with for lifetimes, you have to denounce them. The appetite increases for them the more you denounce them, isn't it? I was absolutely fine until I gave everything up. Now I'm burning. That tapasya, Rupa Goswami says, that's important. At least enough that you can remain in your position of devotion. But it's just the beginning. Don't make a life of it. Don't make a business of it. It's going nowhere. isn't it? Nasadayati mam yogo, nadharmyam sankhyam udhava, nasvadhyayas tapasthyaga, yato bhakti mamorjita. Nothing, none of these things, vairagya, tapasya, they're going anywhere. In the beginning, and just enough that we're able to move forward. Otherwise, Rupa warns. He says the outcome of jnana, vairagya, these things, they make you a hard person. And bhakti is very, very soft. Bhakti is very, very feminine. Isn't it? When the bhakti lata is spoken of by Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he said it's just like a baby girl. You have to take care of it so carefully. Isn't it? So gently. But tapasya, burning yourself, makes you tough. Isn't it? Austerity, renunciation makes you a big man or woman. I am the most in this ashram. You see me on these days of the week. Chaitanya never supported this. Isn't it? When Brahmananda Bharati came to Jagannath Puri, the senior of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, he came wearing a deerskin of a tyagi, of a renunciate. And when they said to Chaitanya, they said, Brahmananda's come, Brahmananda. He said, he's my superior. I should go to him. But when Mahaprabhu went, he came, and Brahmananda is right in front of him. They're saying, here's Brahmananda. He's saying, where is Brahmananda? I can't see Brahmananda. I can only see someone here wearing a deerskin. Brahmananda wouldn't wear the deerskin. Brahmananda thought, oh. Mahaprabhu disapproves. Yes, he disapproved of this external show of renunciation. Like Prabhupada said, we're not Karal Swamis, the wooden shoe Swamis. You put on the big shoes. Sometimes in Vrindavan, one time this person came walking through Vrindavan. He had big wooden Karals on, they were this height. And he was walking down the street in his sannyas with the beard, the hair, and everybody was like, wow, the clunk of those shoes battering the road as he went down the path. In front of the Gurukul, the whole street came out. We were all on the roof. We're like, what is that? We used to call them platforms in the 70s. Shoes like that. Prabhupada says, we're not Karal Swamis. We don't make a big exhibition of these things. It needs to be the internals. So the tapasya, the vairagya, these things, only in as much as they aid bhakti. Sometimes arop siddhi bhakti, these things are called, no, they are sangha siddhi. By their association, these things get benefit. But they're useful. And in the beginning they're useful, but only in as much as with their obstacles. Narad Rishi in the Bhakti Sutra, he mentions this. Tasmat anyatha cha. Tasmat anyatha cha. Virodeshu. And last word. Udasinata cha. That bhakti is that complete, exclusive dedication to him, to Krishna. Virodeshu, and everything that's in opposition to that, udashinataha, complete indifference. Indifference, not attraction or repulsion. Complete indifference. That culturing that indifference in the beginning is tapasya. You have to bear it. It's bearing forth, standing up to it, pushing on, despite everything that's going in the opposite direction. And that's the only relationship, tapasya. Tapasya is blessed by bhakti to have that relationship. But it's the only area of where this thing serves the purpose of bhakti. But it's not bhakti in and of itself. And by its performance, one will never achieve bhakti. Hare Krishna. Srimad Bhagavatam ki. Maybe one question or comment, if there's one.